This copyrighted audio file from the writings of David S. Lample is offered free of charge to the glory of God the Father and the praise of Jesus Christ our Lord. Detailed copyright and resource information is included at the end of this file.
This is session 136 of our study of 1 Corinthians. Our passage is chapter 14, verses 6 to 9. And I've entitled this study, Clarity, Part 1. Please turn to the fourth chapter of the Old Testament book, Nehemiah. Governor Nehemiah was surrounded by enemies. Many did not want him to complete the work assigned to him by God, that is, to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. Chief among his opponents were Sanballat, effectively governor of Samaria, and Tobiah, his faithful sidekick. The strengthening of Jerusalem would erode some of their political power in the region. So they actively conspired to stop the work on its walls by any means, even by violence. So instead of stopping the dangerous work, which is what they wanted him to do, Nehemiah armed those doing the work and he established a method to rally the men to any place on the wall being threatened. Let's read verses 16 to 20 in chapter 4. From that day on, half of my servants carried on the work while half of them held the spears, the shields, the bows, and the breastplates. And the captains were behind the whole house of Judah. Those who were rebuilding the wall and those who carried burdens took their load with one hand doing the work and the other holding a weapon. As for the builders, each wore his sword girded at his side as he built, while the trumpeter stood near me. I said to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people, "The work is great and extensive, and we are separated on the wall far from one another. At whatever place you hear the sound of the trumpet, rally to us there. Our God will fight for us." I love Nehemiah. It's a great story. Profound story. And let me just add an off-topic sidebar here. Just as an aside, I want to make sure we pay due notice to what Nehemiah said in that last statement. It's indicative of the faith of the man that he did not say, "Rally to us there and together we will fight the enemy." No, Nehemiah said, "Rally to us there and our God will fight for us." Nehemiah was a faithful man of prayer. He talked to God all the time. More to the point of our current lesson. Nehemiah kept a trumpeter at his side to sound the alarm whenever the wall was threatened. Now just imagine how that would have worked out if the musician, when told to sound the alarm, decided to render instead some lyrical pianissimo lullaby. Well, first off, most working on the wall would not even have heard it. And if they did, would stand there scratching their heads as to its purpose. Is it the alarm, or is the musician just serenading the governor as he eats his lunch? The Apostle Paul, in our passage, using three such musical illustrations, makes the point that edification comes by way of a clear, strong, understandable voice, not by way of incoherent babbling. Let's read our considerably longer passage than usual. 1 Corinthians 14, beginning with verse 6. "But now, brethren, if I come to you speaking in tongues, what will I profit you, unless I speak to you either by way of revelation or of knowledge, or prophecy, or of teaching. Yet even lifeless things, either flute or harp, in producing a sound, if they do not produce a distinction in the tones, how will it be known what is played on the flute or on the harp? For if the bugle produces an indistinct sound, who will prepare himself for battle? So also you, unless you utter by the tongue speech that is clear, how will it be known what is spoken? For you will be speaking into the air. There are perhaps a great many kinds of languages in the world, and no kind is without meaning. If then I do not know the meaning of the language, I will be to the one who speaks it a barbarian, and the one who speaks will be a barbarian to me. So also you, since you are zealous of spiritual gifts, seek to abound for the edification of the church. Therefore, let one who speaks in a tongue pray that he may interpret. Now we're ready for verse 6. But now, brethren, if I come to you speaking in tongues, what will I profit you unless I speak to you either by way of revelation, or of knowledge, or of prophecy, or of teaching? Paul opens this paragraph with what all our common versions translate now, or but now, but which commentators suggest means something like, but as it is, which is how Fee does it, or Garland suggests, let us look at the facts. That is, beginning in verse 6, he shows evidence to substantiate, to illustrate what he has been saying thus far in verses 1 to 5. And let me add an important note here. This series of illustration works regardless your position on tongues. Whether you believe the New Testament reference to speaking in tongues always means speaking in a known but alien foreign language, as in Acts 2, or elsewhere refers to spirit talk in the language of heaven, as Paul describes in this chapter, the principle set forth in these verses holds true. Even if your position is that the gift of tongues ceased altogether after the first century, which is a position held by many, the principle still applies. Know your audience. Speak in a manner they will understand. And that is precisely what took place in Acts 2. So that the people, this multinational crowd around the apostles, would understand the gospel, the Spirit of God gave each of the apostles the ability to speak in each of these foreign languages. Know your audience, speak in a manner they will understand. Here Paul sets up a hypothetical situation in which he visits their church and speaks to them, implied, only in tongues. If he did, he points out, there would be no profit, no benefit to them because they would not understand what he was saying. Commentators struggle to find deep meaning in Paul's choice of the gifts of, quote, of revelation or of knowledge or prophecy or of teaching, but it would seem that he is simply using them as examples of speaking that is intelligible, standing against the unintelligible tongues. What is the point of it all if no one understands what you are saying? That's his point. Why bother? Then he continues in verse 7. Yet even lifeless things, either flute or harp, in producing a sound, if they do not produce a distinction in the tones, how will it be known what is played on the flute or on the harp? Our common versions offer variations on the first word of verse 7, amos, translated in the NASB, yet. I think the NIV is helpful with its typically verbose, even in the case of. That's good. That sets it up nicely. Even in the case of lifeless things. So Paul proceeds to illustrate his point with three musical examples. His use of lifeless, which means inanimate, to describe the instruments reflects common usage of the time. Used this way in Euripides, Plutarch, the Septuagint. It was just a common way to describe a musical instrument. Without a human being, it's lifeless, it's inanimate, it just lays there. If they do not produce a distinction in the tones. The word distinction can also be translated separation. That is, if one is just randomly running one's hands over all the strings of the harp, the result is not a pleasing melody. That would be separate, distinct notes, but just painful cacophony, mush. I'm reminded of Rush Limbaugh, who just this last Wednesday passed away at the age of 70 from lung cancer. He had been totally deaf for a number of years. With the aid of a cochlear implant, some of his hearing had been restored so that he could carry on the radio, carry on speaking to people. When it came to music, however, his memory had to come into play. His memory was required. He reported that if the song to which he was listening was familiar to him, if he had heard it before, knew the melody, he was able to hear the tune as it was played. But if the song was unfamiliar, he could not make out the distinctive tune, but heard only harsh, irritating noise, which is what unintelligible tongues are in comparison to the clear speaking of prophecy, teaching, etc. Now, verse 8. For if the bugle produces an indistinct sound, who will prepare himself for battle? Now the apostle offers an illustration of more critical importance than just musical entertainment. From time immemorial, military commanders have used various means to signal their troops, to send orders of movement, or just call them to arms. The piercing sound by the trumpet or bugle was and has been a common means to both signal action and rouse the fighting spirit of the men. And this was how Nehemiah signaled to the men rebuilding the Jerusalem wall that they were to rally to the spot where those opposed to that work were causing trouble. A bugle was used, a trumpet was used to call across to the far side of the city, to call people to action. The word translated indistinct in the NASB, Adalon, is, I think, best in the King James versions. Uncertain. That's good. That paints a good picture. That's the idea behind Adalon. Hidden, unseen, concealed, not manifest. And if so, to another person, it's uncertain. What's going on here? They might not even notice it at all, which was the case in the only other instance of this word in the New Testament. Jesus used it to describe the Pharisees. Turn, please, to Luke chapter 11. Luke 11, and let's begin with verse 43. Woe to you, Pharisees, for you love the chief seats in the synagogues and the respectful greetings in the marketplaces. Woe to you, for you are like concealed tombs, and the people who walk over them are unaware of it. So Jesus uses this word, translated concealed, to accuse the Pharisees of being tombs underground, not even marked. People walk over them, they don't even know they're there. The reason for a bugle in battle is for it to deliver a recognizable call to the combatants. Trained soldiers know what to expect, so when they hear something they cannot recognize, there results only confusion, inaction, and perhaps death. Gordon Fee points out a good contemporary analogy. Now, it's been many years since I've attended a live performance of a symphony orchestra, but I believe my memory serves that there are two things that occur before the entrance of the conductor. One person plays, one person in the orchestra stands up, and I believe it's typically not a string instrument, but a wind instrument that plays an A440, probably a clarinet, something like that, or a trumpet, to which everyone tunes their own instrument. Either before or after this, it has been many years, the sound from the stage dissolves into a sea of cacophony as individual musicians woodshed troublesome passages or just warm up their chops and their instruments. The result is a symphony of disordered bedlam. Mush. No tune, no melody. The instruments not unified, but actually fighting against each other as they go their own way. But then the conductor mounts his podium, taps his stand for attention, and with a dramatic downbeat, suddenly, almost miraculously, all that disorder is turned into order, as all those individuals coalesce into a unified whole, following the music and their leader. And at once, cacophony becomes music. Though Paul continues this along this same line, deeper into the paragraph, we'll conclude with verse 9 in this session. So also you, unless you utter by the tongue speech that is clear, how will it be known what is spoken? For you will be speaking into the air. If the orchestra is not unified under the score set before it, how will anyone hear the message of the music? And of course, more to the point, if one does not speak in a distinct, understandable language, clearly assumed to be a public gathering such as corporate worship or instruction, then no one will know what you are saying. What is the point if there is no edification? Here Paul uses the organ of speech, the literal tongue, as just another of the musical instruments he has mentioned above. Fee translates this, unless you speak intelligible words with your tongue, how will anyone know what you are saying? And then he ends the verse, for you will be speaking into the air. One is reminded of what Paul wrote in chapter 9. Let's look at that. Chapter 9. Let's begin with verse 25. Everyone who competes in the games exercises self-control in all things. They then do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. Therefore I run in such a way as not without aim. I box in such a way as not beating the air. The idea of a room full of people babbling incoherently just to prove their own spirituality is antithetical to kingdom life. There is an American idiom that might also apply to the Corinthian congregation. Quote, speaking just to hear oneself talk, end quote. That is, just amusing yourself and no one else. That may be appropriate in the private prayer closet, but not in corporate worship. But we would be remiss if we didn't extend this principle before we were done. One does not have to be speaking in tongues to be unintelligible. I'm reminded of a recent how-to video I started watching for an application I was using. And the person presenting this audio, which was him speaking while we watched what he was doing on his computer monitor, going through the various steps he was describing. He was so young. He had a foreign accent, foreign to me, accent. But more to that, he was speaking so fast that I couldn't understand most of the words he was saying. And what he was doing on his computer screen was flying by so fast that my mind couldn't record it. What are you doing? And I thought, this is supposed to be an instructional video and it's gibberish. I don't understand a word you're saying because you're speaking so fast and you're doing things so fast I can't remember or make note of what you're doing. What's the point? This obviously is not intended for me. Maybe there's some people who can watch it, but I can't. I could get enough out of it to know that he probably knew the topic. He knew what he was saying, but he was presenting it so poorly that it wasn't getting through. He was just speaking into the air for his own benefit. The principle applies any time one believer is speaking to another, even when a believer is speaking to a non-believer, perhaps more so. How important is it that we speak clearly and intelligently to those who do not yet know the Lord? They may be lost for eternity if we are haphazard about what we're saying to them, or speaking in a totally different language, which could very well be the language of the church, to a non-believer. There have been times in our classroom when I am met with one or more faces expressing predominantly, "What in the world are you talking about?" It's usually some variation on a frown, a quizzical look. "What are you talking about?" At such times, I know either I have not expressed myself well or I have introduced a concept that requires more explanation. In either case, I have probably not spoken with clarity, or as Paul puts it in verse 9, speech that is clear. Know your audience. Know how to speak to them, whether it's one or 1,000. I remember years ago reading a journal that was intended for writers giving advice, and it offered the advice of a well-known writer of detective pulp fiction, the kind of book you can read in one sitting. Boilerplate. And he said, never use a word you have to look up in the dictionary. Well, now, that wouldn't apply to all writers, but it did apply to his audience. His audience didn't want to hear or read 50-cent words, words that made them scratch their head. What does that word mean? No, they wanted simple, clear language. That's what they expected from him, and that's what he said. If I have to look it up in the dictionary, I don't use it. Know your audience. There is a reason we do not conduct the Sunday worship service in our church in the language of Lower Slobovia. No one here speaks that language. What would be the point? And there is a reason we do not include a time for everyone to speak at will in tongues. No one here speaks that language. What would be the point?
Thank you for using our Bible study resources. This has been the audio version of our weekly printed session notes. It is copyright 2021 by David S. Lample, but is offered free of charge and may be freely shared with others. All printed and audio notes are available in the Bible Studies section of our website at dlample.com. This website also includes our monthly devotional, Reflections by the Pond, as well as archives of our devotional publications made available for over 30 years. Unless otherwise indicated, scripture in this audio file is from the New American Standard Bible, updated edition, copyright, Lockman Foundation. Greek and Hebrew citations and definitions are from Strong's Greek and Hebrew Dictionary and the NASB Greek-Hebrew Dictionary. All resources, both at our devotional site, dlample.com, and our His Company Christian Drama site, hc.dlample.com, are offered free of charge in acknowledgement of the Lordship of Jesus Christ. For more information about who we are, please visit the About Us page at our website.